Today is Saturday, July 25th. My name is Linda Lenski, and I have the privilege to be interviewing Jane Rowe today. Jane is going to tell her story. So, Jane, to start out, why don't you tell us a little bit about, first of all, how old you are, a little bit about your family of origin, where you were born and grew up, and I'll have you just unfold your story for us.
Okay, Linda, I can do that. I was born in the southwestern part of Wisconsin in Lancaster to a school teacher and his formerly school teaching wife, Phil and Mary Brewer. However, when I was 2 years old, Dad, this was 1932, I'm 77 years old, and in 1932 the Depression was very nearly at its worst. It was the year the banks failed. And I was born on Good Friday. My father never ceased reminding me of the fact when I did something that he didn't quite approve of. Well, what can you expect of a kid who was born on Good Friday, the year the banks failed? And he didn't reprove me very often, so it was okay. It was kind of a joke among us. But anyway, he was very fortunate in getting a job in a Milwaukee suburb, Whitefish Bay, now known colloquially as White Folks Bay, just outside of Milwaukee. We were two suburbs up the lake shore. A little bit analogous, I think, to living your life. I lived there through high school, living your life in Maple Bluff in Madison. Although I think there's more of a middle class element in Whitefish Bay. You just don't see it when you drive through. People see the mansions along the lake when they go along the highway, and that's not the way it was. It certainly was not the way it was on our part of town, because ours was very middle class. We had a small business owner on one side and a mail carrier on the other side, and of course Dad as a school teacher wasn't making bundles of money either. But I grew up in that suburb, and it was quite an interesting experience because part of it was just right for me. The school system was terrific, and I apparently from the get-go had an academic set. I'm subject even now to a great deal of intellectual excitement. I was very moved by and driven by books, reading, listening to stories. My folks used to laugh that they had read when I was about, 14 months old, they started reading me a funny little rhyme tale called Muggins' Mouse, and they knew it by heart. I wanted it so many times. I can still recite part of it. I'll spare you that, though. And books were just a very dominant theme, and Whitefish Bay was a perfect place for that because it was considered an extremely desirable place to teach. They always had loads of candidates for every teaching job. Dad felt very fortunate to get his. He was a history teacher when he took the job. And it was perfect for me. I was just made for that kind of school system. The rest of it was not perfect. Whitefish Bay's a very homogeneous, or was, I shouldn't speak to its present, I stay away from there now, but very homogeneous, very straight, very conformist culture unto itself. Maybe most of the wealthier suburbs are like that, I don't know that either, but it was very important to at least appear to fit the norm. And the norm could be pretty rigid. And so the rest of me didn't fit too well. I was an outrageously tomboyish kid, as we'll be hearing from many, many lesbians, I'm sure. I chuckled when the brand of clothing that Trett Fury brought out was called Tomboy Girl, because I thought, boy, there wasn't such a phrase then. It was tomboy, and it was kind of pejorative. It was nothing like, it wasn't as bad as a boy being called a sissy, but it was not a compliment. And you were supposed to outgrow it overnight with your first menstrual period, which was a bit tricky. I was really in, as a kid, was the era of cowboys, Tom Mix and stuff. I was really into being a cowboy. Being a cowboy was really difficult in Whitefish Bay. Cowgirls were marginally permitted. With a great deal of help from my doting grandfather, a farmer, I managed to save enough money to purchase a real leather cowgirl outfit with a leather skirt and a fringed leather vest and a plaid flannel shirt and a wonderful hat and a gun in a holster, and my life was made, except I didn't have cowboy boots, which was very sad. I spent much of the rest of my life craving some really good boots, good high clompy boots, and finally did get some, but I think I was in my 40s before I got a satisfactory pair. Anyway, that was the kind of thing that meant a lot to me, and I spent hours and hours bouncing on a very flexible tree limb out behind the garage that became a pony, and I had a burlap saddle, and so I could live the tomboy life in my head, and it was fine. I climbed trees a lot, which my mother found aggravating. My mother was a farm girl from the southwestern part of the state, did become a teacher, had some education, but was very, very struck by, I would say almost in love with Whitefish Bay. She loved the cleanliness of it. Growing up on a farm where flies and manure and straw were a constant battle to keep out of the house. She loved the orderliness of it. She loved the educational level of nearly everybody. She was a little self-conscious about not having gone to college for 4 years, but she was an omnivorous reader, and that certainly compensated. She was very, very bright. And she just was crazy about Whitefish Bay. Dad was crazy about the Whitefish Bay school system, but the life didn't appeal to him as much. He had a terrific outlet all of his life. Starting in high school, he had his own dance band. He was a drummer, and he had a sort of escape because he kept his own band all the way through high school. He played for a lot of our high school dances, which was fun. And he was Pappy Brewer at that point. And so that was something that would take him out of that culture. But I had a considerable struggle with the culture. The saving grace was always then, as it has been ever since, that I had really, really good, I want to say women friends. Of course, in those days, they were girlfriends. I had a marvelous best friend named Gingy Miller in grade school. And I used to pick her up. She lived above Nellie Jones's grocery store, and I would stop and holler for her on the way to school. And we would walk up the street, often arm in arm, and we had silly things we did. The first thing we always did, it was ritual, was try to stump each other with a word from the dictionary. We had great words. Gingy had an extensive vocabulary, and so did I, and we loved matching wits on that. And so that was the thing we greeted each other with. So it was a great vocabulary building friendship. And then we did some rather strange walking. We called it heffalump walking, and it might be toe out or toe in, and I think we looked like one deformed creature walking up Henry Clay Street to school, but we got enormous pleasure from it. A great deal of giggling went on, and it was a very bonding kind of thing. And she loved books as much as I did, and loved playing outdoors as much as I did, and loved trading bees. We used to trade comic books and marbles and all the accoutrements of kids in the 1930s and 40s. And so having that strong friendship all through grade school, that was another nice thing about Whitefish Bay. We had three rather small grade schools, and you knew the same kids all the way through school, and then you just blended in high school. I was in the same school building from kindergarten through eighth grade, so I knew everybody and their foibles very, very well. And that created a sort of subculture in which a lot of eccentricities, such as my tomboyishness and my tendency to get straight A's, were tolerated, whereas out in the adult world, it was a little less acceptable to be a tomboy. So that was kind of an interesting background. I had a good escape from that, however. My mom came from a farm, as I said, and her two brothers still ran the farm. My grandparents had retired and moved into Montfort, the nearest town, and the farm was my summer escape and my school holiday escape, and especially as my grandparents' age, my parents went out there all the time. During the Depression, they used to drive out there and fill up the car with farm vegetables and meats, and it saw us through. Mom and Dad also kept boarders and roomers during those days because that helped make the budget stretch, and we ate much better than many people during the Depression because the one or two school teachers who lived with us every year pretty much paid the food bills with their room and board, the things that we had to buy additionally to what came from the farm. So we did pretty well. I don't recall ever going really hungry during the Depression, as so many did. We had to ultimately endure the food rationing of the war and so on, but we didn't go hungry. So it was really, in a lot of ways, a very good life. But I always felt confined by the social norms of Whitefish Bay. I just didn't fit them quite. It felt scratchy. And the only thing that preserved me was the friendship with Gingy in grade school, and then ultimately a very bonded group of girls who were pretty much the brains in high school. And in junior high, I remember, we had important things, connections with one another. One was that if you had to wear a snowsuit to school, if your mother made you wear a snowsuit to school, which was very icky, you called someone on the telephone tree, and then they would wear their snowsuit, and they'd call. So when you had to turn up in a snowsuit, everybody that was important to you had a snowsuit on. So nobody was icky. It was a kind of a trend then. And that's the kind of bonding that helped carry me through the other expectations that were pretty difficult. So that was the picture in Whitefish Bay. Meanwhile, I was having a really good time out on the farm where my cousins worked very hard, but seemed wild and free by comparison. They didn't have the same kind of expectations of them. They weren't expected to set the table just right. They weren't expected to wear just certain clothes. They were a little peculiar about hair. I knew one girl in the high school there who was so peculiar about hair that I never saw her without curlers. She wore curlers all day long. In those days, we had huge metal curlers or flour sacks. No, they were sugar sacks. Sugar sacks that you tied up your hair to get big curls, and you could do pretty well. I used the sugar sack things, and you could do pretty well with them by way of creating a page boy or whatever the fashion called for. And they were really into hair out there, but they didn't mess with other stuff, so it was kind of nice. You could feel more free, and my aunts were much freer about things too, so I had a sort of outlet out there. The tomboy Jane sort of fitted out there, and I was Grandpa Rowe's pet. He had 6, 9 residential grandchildren on the farm, all of whom he was a very stern authority figure to, and he was a complete pushover for me. Even out in Montfort or at home, Grandpa was my man, and I emulated him to the extent that my mother thought I was walking like him. I've always had a rather strange, rather masculine gait, and Mother would say very often, she'd say, "Jane, you're walking like your grandfather again, and there are no plowed fields in Whitefish Bay. You don't have to walk that way here," but of course I couldn't change it. I learned just a few years ago when I was in my 60s that I have a strangely twisted femur, and that dictated my walk, not my grandfather. But I so loved my grandfather that I was quite pleased to walk like him. And I wish there were plowed fields in Whitefish Bay, so there. And I didn't mind having a masculine walk, and I like to put it in my hands in my pockets and exaggerate it. It seemed to me, which was certainly true in that era, that all of the power in the world and most of the money rested with men. And it's curious that I held that view so strongly. I mean, I was definitely an incipient feminist of the militant sort as a kid, because I noticed that and I wanted to address it personally. Interestingly enough, my mother, who was very, very, very careful about her role as a wife and mother and social person, trying to meet all of the norms, was also really a feminist, because she wore all this costumery, but she went right ahead and ran everything that she got her hands on, including my father. She was miscast in her life. She should have been probably wouldn't have done to be president, because she wasn't tactful enough, she wasn't political, but she would have made a great CEO of a very large and complex organization, company. She would have run it well, made a lot of money, antagonized a whole lot of people, and would resemble some of the people that we don't like now who are doing the same thing and are usually men. But she would have been very, very good at it, but they weren't talking about glass ceilings or women doing anything in those days, so she was confined. So mostly all she did was run every organization she was in and clean the hell out of the house, which was really difficult to live with. This is a woman, Linda, who cleaned between the floorboards with hairpins and did the registers of the house, the hot air registers, every week, vacuumed every day. My dad, when I was in high school, my dad and I walked to school in the morning and then came home for lunch, because those days women were expected. It was presumed that mothers would be home, especially in Whitefish Bay. No mothers had to work unless they were widowed. And so dad and I would walk home at noon, and about 4 times a year, as we rounded the corner and looked down Diversity Boulevard where we lived, we would see a house with all of the furniture out in the front yard. And that would be our house, and Mother would be doing her version of spring cleaning or fall cleaning and we would look at each other and groan, because we knew she was going to be in filthy humor, and we were going to be eating standing up and maybe out in the front porch. It was awful. I mean, she did the housewife thing. She put the furniture on scatter rugs and hauled it out. She didn't remove the appliances, the large appliances. She left the refrigerator, stove, sink, etc. But I'm not kidding you. She brought the Davenport, all the armchairs, the desks, everything on the ground floor came out into the front yard so she could get properly down into that carpeting and those floorboards. And it was really a sight. Did not make me want to be a housewife, did not. I thought it was the most appalling demonstration of a woman's life going wrong that I could possibly witness. I didn't particularly like my mother. I loved her. I feared her. She was a strong presence in my life. But most of the things that she did, I found appalling. I found her social life deadly dull. So did Dad, by the way, whenever he had to get involved in it. But she played endless games of bridge. Whoever was hostess would set up maybe four card tables, put freshly ironed linen cloths on them, linen napkins. You're nodding, you must have lived through this era too. And the good silver and little teacups, and I think they did drink coffee out of them, but they would hold about half a cup, you know. Mugs they were not. And they would play very earnest games of bridge, and then they would have these long conversations that would bore a gopher. I tell you, they were just awful. The things like a whole table full of presumably intelligent, well-read women talking about wallpapering the bathroom for hours. It would just go on. That's what I remember, is they talked about wallpapering a lot, which I thought was an awful thing to do anyhow, but to talk about it, my God. What patterns they chose, they go on and on. So it's just this kind of drone. So my entire picture of what a grown woman's life consisted of was, oh my God, let me out of here. I don't want that. And so I had a sort of semi-conscious plan to live my life very differently. It didn't have a whole lot of shape. It was more based on what I didn't want to be than what I felt I could be. I had models and I didn't recognize them. My models were a whole bunch of really excellent, almost exclusively single, I believe one was widowed, school teachers, particularly in high school. During the Depression, there was an actual law or ordinance in most municipalities that women could not have teaching jobs unless they were widowed, because divorce wasn't considered a thing you could do anyway, because men needed the jobs. Jobs were so scarce. And that tended to prevail, so that maybe two-thirds of the high school staff were women, and they were terrific women because they'd won the contest to be teachers in Whitefish Bay. They were great women, great role models, and great teachers, just extraordinary teachers. And I think a goodly number of them, or at least some of them, were lesbians. But I did not know the word. The word was not spoken in our household, and I did not encounter it, surprisingly, in my vast reading, or if I did, I passed over it, not recognizing it, until I was a junior in high school, at which point our school newspaper, of which I was co-editor, won a national award, and my co-editor and good friend, Joe Sari and I got to go to New York with our two advisors. And that was just a tremendous thing. And at one point during this mind-blowing experience in New York, a cab driver said, "Well, where should I take you girls? Do you want to go to a lesbian bar?" And both chaperones turned bright red. And we looked at them, and I thought he said thespian, actually. But the word got clarified in the course of the very halting discussion afterwards. And they, with great difficulty, told us what, Joe didn't know either, what lesbians were. And it just didn't register. What registered with me was the extreme difficulty our chaperones had with the word. It was clearly not a Whitefish Bay sort of word. It was a New York word. I didn't think of it as particularly dirty or suspect, but it was definitely not part of our Whitefish Bay vocabulary. And that stuck in my mind, and not a whole lot stuck in my mind quite as strongly as that during that era, so it was interesting. But I'm betting that a lot of those, or a fair number of those brilliant women, predictably, of course, the Phi Ed teachers, who were also great, were lesbians, but of course I had no sense of that. And in those days, the word wasn't used among themselves. People were friends. She lives with her friend, Marie. She lives with her friend, Dorothy, and so on and so forth. So they were tremendous role models in terms of intellectual accomplishment and excitement and even joy. I I still am in correspondence with one of my high school teachers who must by now be in her late 90s, who left me with a bibliography from world literature that I am still pursuing. She left me with so much excitement about people that you don't always get excited about, like Norwegian authors and all the Russians, of course, and just wonderful people all over the world, that it's just stayed with me, and I've followed up in that vein. And I always think, thank you, Laurie Dangle, because that was so tremendous. Laurie was not, I think, a lesbian. She lived with her sister, who also lived to a ripe old age, is dead now, but and still lives in her own home and keeps a big garden. But I don't believe she was a lesbian. Too bad. I think she would have been great in the culture, because she sure was smart and she sure was a great teacher. Anyway, that was my introduction to the word lesbian, so that was kind of interesting, and I had no picture of that happening. I had terrible crushes, particularly on one of those two chaperones, who was my French teacher. I had the traditional crush on my gym teacher in 7th and 8th grade, but that everybody else did too. Interestingly enough, her name was something Merrick, and we always called her Butch. With total naivete, we had no sense that this was a word that would come to have quite a definite meaning in a later time in our lives. So we all fell in love with Butch Merrick, but it was kind of a trendy thing to do, is just what you did. And I did, and I had crushes on boys too, so that was fine. I dated, had a boyfriend middle school, who was a really great dancer, and we came in second in a dancing contest, which is interesting because I still have two left feet. I don't know how we did that, but and had an excruciatingly boring boyfriend my sophomore year, who my mother just loved. That should have been a warning signal. He was just deadly dull, but he was a way to get to dances, and he was a nice enough kid. I didn't want to hurt his feelings. I had to go to the junior prom with Clark. I didn't even like his name, Clark. And it was really a difficult experience. Well, for starters, Mom had to haul me out of a tree to get my gown on. I forgot about girdles, Linda. You aren't old enough to remember girdles. Oh, you are. You remember girdles. Well, they're a trauma for sure. That was a much greater trauma for me than my first menstrual period, which in any case I didn't have till I was about a junior in high school. But you had to go and be fitted before you had any suspicion of womanly curves. They had to be held in, maybe in advance. Maybe it was a preventative thing so you wouldn't get hips or get breasts. I don't know. But you got put in this awful thing with dangling garters, and you had to wear stockings, which ran the minute you did anything. You didn't have to kick a soccer ball. You got runs in the darn things. And try to climb a tree in something like that. It was just awful. So, you know, you had to be very selective about when you wore them. And I hated it. I just hated it. I bet people who go home from jail on bracelets don't hate their bracelet as much as I hated that girdle. It was not just how it felt, which was awful. They had metal-based bones in them that stabbed you in the midriff. But it was what it stood for, that women have to be confined. To me, it was like bound feet for the Chinese women. It was forced pressure. Anyhow, the girdle was a curse. I wasn't actually wearing one when I was up in the tree. In fact, I hadn't showered, and I wasn't ready to go to the prom, and Mother had a little hysterical fit out in the front yard. Jane, get down out of that tree. Clark is coming in half an hour, and you are up in a tree. And that was kind of the story of life. We had a really good climbing tree across the street, which meant much more to me throughout my life, my early life, than Clark, but so be it. Clark did, however, have a great friend with a Model A car with a rumble seat. And that was another cool thing. We got to ride in the rumble seat, and it was pretty chilly a lot of the time, but it was very, very cool to be going to dances and be the one in the rumble seat. So I liked that. So I was guilty of enjoying some aspects of this rather doubtful, extremely lacking in passion type of relationship. I'm not sure we did hold hands, because I remember his hands were sort of flaccid, and I thought, ick. I was not interested at all. He was always very clean, I'll say that for him. But anyway, then, perhaps predictably, I fell in love in the southwestern part of the state. We had another thing that shadowed people's childhoods at that time, particularly in suburban Milwaukee, was poliomyelitis. Polio epidemics just raged in the summertime. They didn't know the source of it, the cause of it. they did think that the best thing to do with children particularly was to isolate us. And we were confined to our backyards for whole summers a couple of times. And I remember playing Monopoly at the corner where my fences met with two good friends, one Ruthie Sundemeyer, who lived over the back fence, and Joni somebody who lived to the left. And we had an ongoing Monopoly game for most of the summer. We loaned each other millions because we didn't want to stop. And so we kind of violated it, but we had to stay in our own yards, and it was icky. The alternative to that was to stay away all summer. And so I pleaded with my folks to let me stay in Montford all summer with my grandparents. And Grandma said she'd be glad to have me, and we got along well. And so I went down there for the summer. And then the epidemic raged into the fall, and our family doctor advised my parents to have me start school in Montford because it would be dangerous. I would have no immunity if you did. They just didn't know anything about the darn disease. And one of my cousins was totally paralyzed by it, so everybody just who lived just down the street, everybody was just in awful fear of polio. So my folks left me to the tender mercies of Montford High School, which was quite an experience. Everything there was kind of on the level of about seventh grade. And I was a junior, and it was about on the level of seventh grade in Whitefish Bay. It was just unbelievably behind what our academic standards were in Whitefish Bay. But it sure was a lot of fun. And I met, through double dating with my cousin, I met a Norwegian farm boy named Unner Nelson. His real name was Junior, but he had a speech impediment, and he called himself Unner, so everybody else called him Unner. And I was wildly in love with Unner Nelson and everything he represented for most of the year following. It was until the next summer, so it was just about a year. We double dated a lot. My cousin Audrey, who was a close friend, and we were of like age, and she dated Stanley, his older brother. And Unner was curly-headed and had a big smile and a relaxed attitude toward life and as unacademic as they come. And when I had to go back to Whitefish Bay, ultimately, in about late October, the doctor advised that they wait till the first freeze. Why, Unner and I had a really interesting correspondence. I wish to heck I had those letters, because I would write, I was studying pretty advanced literature at that point, and I would do things like write him sonnets in the Shakespearean style, and I would get back these marginally literate letters, which were earnest and loving, but not, the spelling was awful, the grammar was awful, the sentence structure was awful. I thought they were marvelous. He always put SWAK on the envelope sealed with a kiss, and that was the significant thing. And I would share them with my envious friends. Most of the girls I hung around with were brains and hence didn't date. And they thought it was marvelous that I had this handsome farm boy boyfriend. And when I read his letters, I always cleaned them up a lot. I cleaned up the grammar, and he sounded greatly more educated than he was. And I really got into being a farmer's wife. That was going to be my way out of Whitefish Bay. I was going to be a farmer's wife. I subscribed to a journal on farming, one I think also on keeping chickens. I was particularly interested in keeping chickens. And my whole life plan was to have six little curly-headed Norwegian children and bake and can and help pitch hay, and I was really into it. I even loved the way Unner smelled. He smelled of silage all the time. And it's not the perfume of everyone's choice, but I loved it. I loved it. I still like the smell of silage to this day. He was such a dear boy. Fortunately, not at all predatory. It was a very sexually pure relationship. Kind of strange in a way, because it would have thrown me a lot, I think, if he had been groping or difficult to handle in any way physically, and he simply was not. He was just very loving. He was just a nice kid, so it was a great first real love experience, and I'm grateful for it to this day. I don't think you could do better by way of a real first boyfriend. However, he realized before I did, I was so deep in my fantasy world of becoming, I was reading books, all my books were set on farms, I was projecting everything into this farming future, and he had a strong sense as the letter writing went on and the visits went on that it wasn't going to work, that this kid who wrote sonnets was not going to magically overnight turn into a farmer's wife. Oh, I had Thanksgiving dinner with his family on their farm. And they served lutefisk and lefse, and it was my first encounter with lutefisk. And they just rolled it up in the lefse and ate it, I've learned since, to disguise it in mashed potatoes and things. But they just rolled it up, and I had to leave the table and throw up right afterwards. It was not a happy experience. But everything else about that relationship was happy until we broke up. And I was just really crushed when one night Ooner said, "You know, Jane, this isn't really going to work. It's not working for me now, and I don't think it's going to work for you." And I was a tragic figure for a couple of weeks, and then I realized he was absolutely right. It was not working. I could maybe edit his letters when I read them aloud, but I couldn't edit him, and it wouldn't be good to want to, because for what he was perfect. He was in his time, as Margaret Mead always said of her various husbands, in his time he was just right, and that's the way Ooner was. In his time, he was just right. So my senior year evolved into something very different and very kind of foreboding. I began hanging out. My grandfather started having strokes and becoming very incapacitated, and had one pretty major one. And my grandma was much burdened with his care, and we started spending a lot more time in Montford almost every weekend during the school year. And I started hanging out with a gang of kids that my cousin was hanging out with, and they drank alcohol, which Ooner also did not do. And we drove around in cars recklessly with every one of us drunk. I don't know how anybody ever survived the experience. We would go to the back doors of bars, and they would pass us. They would sell us things that didn't sell well in the front. You know, we drank the most unbelievable brands of brandy, horrible, horrible things. But if it had alcohol, we were all for it. And all six or eight of us would be dead drunk every Saturday night. How I didn't get caught out, I don't know. I would crawl up the stairs to bed. My parents would already be in bed at my grandma's house. Grandma and grandpa would be in bed. And the deal was, we would all somehow get back into our homes, and then we would meet the next morning in the small town drugstore and piece together the evening. Because it seemed to me that these other kids were unaware of a lot of what happened, blacked out, in other words. I thought it was normal that I did. I thought that was just what happened when you went out drinking. I didn't have any notion that this was an indicator of alcoholism, no notion at all. And indeed, at least one and probably two of those kids have almost certainly gone into lives of being alcoholics, as I did. But it was actually fun. We had these wild adventures. It was so different from Whitefish Bay. It was just so exciting. We'd have these old cars, and we'd go out in the country. And I remember one night it was so foggy that we quite wisely put one of us drunken kids out on the hood so we could see what was coming, riding out in the front of his car and going over one-way bridges. And Linda, we never even had an accident. How we survived, I don't know. And whenever I read of a bunch of kids crashing in some rural environment and a couple of them being killed, I think that's the way they live. That's the way we live. That's what they do. It was awful. And it went on that whole year, ironically sort of setting me up for what was to be my college career at the University of Wisconsin. I decided, that was another thing that Ooner did for me. I had been looking into a variety of colleges. This was nearly a full-time job for guidance counselors in Whitefish Bay, getting you in the proper school. They were really big on getting you in the proper school. And my folks, I was considered scholarship material, so my folks were real hot on the idea of me going to some really highly intellectual, academically achieving, small liberal arts college. Carleton was in contention, and Antioch, and places like that. But after I met Ooner and fell in love, I wanted to be close to Montfort, and I wanted to have agriculture. So University of Wisconsin, and somehow, even though Ooner and I broke up, and I had a pretty strong realization that I was not going to become a farmer's wife, thank God, I stayed with the notion of going to the University of Wisconsin, partly because my best friend by then, Joe Face, was headed that way. I forgot that my friendship with Ginger Miller, Gingy Miller, continued through high school, but we weren't part of the same group of kids because she fell in love with a boy from another high school her freshman year, and they went steady all through high school. So Gingy and I stayed in touch, but we weren't on the same basis anymore, and my new best friend was the young woman who co-edited the high school newspaper with me, Joe Sari, and a military brat who came to Whitefish Bay in high school. And Gingy, unfortunately, tragically, died of leukemia our senior year in high school. And it felt to me like part of my childhood died with her. It was kind of symbolic. All those wonderful things we had had together, this really, really beautiful, sturdy, playful, intelligent, fun childhood thing that we shared was gone, just gone. I have one lovely souvenir of her. I was into photography in an avid way. Oh, that was another escape besides Montfort. I had my own darkroom for a number of years. I was really keen on photography, and I found by having a darkroom in our old fruit cellar, I could stay clear of Mother. Whenever she came downstairs, I said, "Don't come in, I'm developing." And I kept a hot plate down there and cooked my own lunches. I kept a lot of books down there to read. I even did some developing of films, but mostly it was a refuge. So that was, anyway, while I was still in this photography thing about our junior year in high school, I took a really, really good picture of Gingy. And I feel that my love for her showed in it. She was standing against a pillar in the apartment house that she and her mother had to live in after Nellie Jones's store was torn down. And it caught every one of her freckles. She was a little freckled blonde, had a little ski jump nose. She was just cute as a bug. And it just caught her character. She was in a flannel shirt. And I gave that picture to her mother after her death. And it was the memorial. Our high school annual was dedicated to Gingy. And that picture was run in large form on the front cover. And I felt good. I felt like all my photography, if that was the one thing I accomplished, that was good. That was worth it. And because it was a really good picture, and it did sort of capture the Gingy that I had known and loved for so many years. So that was, I think that was one more thing that fueled my disregard for Whitefish Bay life and my life, and made me the risk taker that I became that senior year with all that drinking. But it was kind of a schizophrenic existence, because it wasn't the kind of place, Whitefish Bay High School, where you relaxed when you were a senior. Your grade, your transcript was all set, and you could just go off. We were competitive, hard-driven, and very, very academic right up to the day of graduation, the last exam anyway. We studied ferociously. We read widely. We competed with one another. It was a really, really serious business. And so I had this weird thing where I'd go down to Montfort, be drunk and hang out with this wild, wacky group of kids. They were fun kids. They were really fun. We had a good time together. But, you know, we did drink an incredible amount. And then come back to Whitefish Bay and be, my God, I was the DAR girl for the year. Can you imagine that? Which is supposed to represent, I think, clean living. And I'd come back with these wonderful stories of what we'd done while drunk, and my nice little girlfriends, all of whom were, you know, the honor roll kids, would just be aghast. They all sounded like they had asthma. They, "Oh, you did? Really?" kind of stuff, you know. I loved it. I really loved it. Probably exaggerated greatly, but didn't have too much, just fill in the blanks. Had wonderful stories to tell them. One of my favorites, which I've told in my story at AA many times, is we were at somebody we didn't know's wedding dance in Richland Center, drunk as lords, all of us absolutely drunk out of our minds. And I came to out of a blackout and into a wonderful scene. It was just like something out of a Western movie. There were a bunch of Indians there for some reason, and they were all bashing one another over the head with chairs that usually sit around the outside. And I thought, this is great. This is the absolute opposite of Whitefish Bay. This is really it. This is fun. This is real life. And then I blacked out again and missed the rest. So the next morning, I heard the rest of the story and how ultimately a lot of people ended up, you know, bandaged, and they had to call the police and blah, blah, blah. But we got out of it fine, and it made a great story, and I loved it. I just thought it was the end. And my little friends in Whitefish Bay thought this was, that I was, my double life was just awe-inspiring. They were, you know, it was I think I was sort of a superhero or something, which really wasn't a good thing for an alcoholic kid to experience. I didn't get any disapprobation because my folks didn't know what was going on, and I was just doing this schizophrenic existence. So anyway, eventually went off to the University of Wisconsin, rooming with my best friend, Joe Sari, and the post-World War II ethos was still prevailing at the university, which included the presence of a large number of World War II veterans still on the GI Bill, a lot of them in graduate school, but not all, some of them just starting up. And dorm space was very, very scarce. And Ann Emery Hall, which is where Whitefish Bay girls went to live, was converted to hold more girls. Well, not exactly converted. They just crammed two girls into most of the single rooms and called them double singles, and you got a slight reduction in rent. And you lived in the size of something that was about the size of a lot of walk-in closets I've seen lately in modern homes. It was cozy. But Joe and I were very good friends, and we did well with the bunk beds. We had opposite body clocks. She liked to study late at night, and I liked to get up early in the morning. So I would have the lower bunk because I had to pee a lot more in the night. And I would pull her bedspread down over, and so she could have a light up above, and she would study. And then in the morning, I would get up quietly and tiptoe with my typewriter down to the lounge downstairs and do my papers and my homework and everything in the morning, because I usually got up like 4 a.m. and did my homework because I just could not stay up at night. And I ran into an old friend who had worked for my folks at their summer job at the Fox Point Club. He was the yard boy at the Fox Point Club, had gone to Cornell and transferred back to Wisconsin in his junior year, and we began to date. And his best friend, Louis Esperger, really took to Joe on first try, so the two of us dated the two of them much of our freshman year. And it was an easy camaraderie with lots and lots and lots of beer involved. And it was comfortable, not a difficult relationship. I never felt the love that I felt for Uner, but it was a sort of a good way. I think it was a pass. I think it was probably what lesbians sometimes consciously do later, having a man to show up at some events. It's convenient. Because, horror upon horrors, Joe and I pledged a sorority. My mother made it a condition of my going to the University of Wisconsin that I would belong to a sorority or I couldn't go there. Because she felt that I was, how did she call it? I think rough around the edges. She meant the tomboy thing. My aversion to girdles, my aversion to the costumes of Whitefish Bay, etc. She wanted me to learn good table manners and the social graces and marry a young businessman or something. I don't know what she wanted, but it would be in a sorority. Well, we sort of lucked out because we went through all this horrible rush procedure. Did you ever do this? It's pretty grim. First, you go to a sort of open house thing. Is that the first thing? Oh, I think maybe a T is the first thing because they're checking your social graces. Anyway, you have to dress up and go. Yeah, it's formal rush. You have to go to a T. We did in those days, and we wore gloves. And we didn't wear hats. We were free to that, but we wore girdles, skirts, matching tops and bottoms. Preferably was fall, early fall. It couldn't have been cashmere. Some approved kind of costume. And you had to hold your teacup right and not spill it down your front and not wolf the food and all that kind of stuff. And then the next round was formal rush, and you had to wear a prom dress type thing, only a little more soigné. Mother made me one because we didn't have buckets of money. And you had to wear very high heels and armpit gloves, we used to call them, those gloves that came all the way up, which really were pretty ridiculous. And look elegant, and you're tripping up Langdon Street in all of this gear. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And I don't remember what the entertainment was, but I'm sure it was boring. And then if you got through that and got invited back, then you got to an informal rush, and that was really fun because every sorority would put on some kind of song and dance act, and like musical comedy or something, and you could wear normal clothes, and it was sort of fun. Well, the sorority, only sorority that interested us at all was Delta Gamma because we liked the house and they seemed to have more fun. And then we learned that the reason they really were keen on us was that they'd had too much fun and they were on academic probation. The whole Delta Gamma house was in danger of being whatever happens when you flunk out, closed, I guess, because the school was looking down their disapproving nose at what Delta Gamma's grade point average was. And Joe and I were valedictorian and salutatorian. Actually, she was valedictorian and I was salutatorian of our high school class. And when you come out of Whitefish Bay with credentials like that, they know you're good. It's going to do it back there. Okay. as a result of our previously splendid grade point averages, Delta Gamma was just very keen on joining me. I think we could have spilled soup down our fronts and been perfectly acceptable. They needed our grades, and we knew that, so we were kind of entertained by the whole thing. But we went on with the deal because I didn't have a choice, and Joe was kind of, I think she was willing to play anthropologist among the Aborigines. She, having been a military brat all of her life, she was entirely used to rolling with the punches, and this was a punch, and she could survive it. It was just one more adaptation to a strange ritual. And I felt kind of that way, too, actually. My mother would have been horrified at all the parodies we did of it and the fun. One significant thing out of the sorority connection, however, was that it raised the level of my drinking greatly. My present from my big sister, whose name and face I do not recall at all, we did not have a great bonding experience, I gather, was a falsified ID, because you weren't allowed to drink hard liquor until you were 21, and of course we were pledged at 18 years of age, and that would have entitled us to 3.2 beer, and that wasn't a sorority girl sort of thing to drink all the time. Delta Gamma House was up near the end of Langdon Street near Kennedy Manor, which was a very high-class drinking place just across the street from the Edgewater Hotel. And it was customary to go after our Monday night meetings and after our dance things and whatever kind of social event you went to with whatever kind of weird fraternity boys, we'd end up in Kennedy Manor drinking. And it was very, very important that you have false ID. So I had somebody else's name and somebody else's driver's license and somebody else, and it just seemed to be part of the deal. So I had it anyway. So I was able to drink a significant amount of very potent alcohol from age 18 on in very cocktailish circumstances. They were modeled, I think, on adult cocktail parties that a lot of their parents were familiar with. My parents were not. My parents were very abstemious drinkers. Kept a little bit of alcohol in the house in case they had company who wanted to drink. But it lasted so long, I swear it congealed in the bottom of the bottles like syrup. It was just, they just didn't really drink. And I had one very obviously alcoholic uncle who used to come to visit, and he and his wife would both get roaring drunk every time, and I thought they were a delight. And actually did very well with his alcoholism. He died in his rocking chair at 76, having had a very fun and prosperous life. I don't know what else happened with his alcoholism. He should have met with a lot of disaster, but he didn't. They lived in China for a number of years. He was one of the imperialist businessmen in China, and Mother always said that Dick and Alice learned these vile things like drinking and eating eels in China, and that was their problem, and they played too much mahjong, and they didn't tend to business. She didn't like them. And whenever Uncle Dick was coming, Mother would say, "We need to stock up on ice cubes. Dick and Alice are coming." But that was the extent of drinking in our household, was Uncle Dick's fairly rare visits. So this was a whole new thing to this cocktail party level. And there was a mixture. We ended up, as they say, dating Chuck and Louie for most of our year, but there were a number of forced blind date events that you, again, I suppose it was my big sister, somebody arranged for me to go out.
Oh, here we go.
Somebody or other in the sorority, I think it was my big sister, fixed me up with a great hulking young man whom she proudly declared was a center on the Wisconsin football team. I wasn't any more interested in football than I was in sororities, but I did go to the games because that's what you did. And so he looked vaguely familiar. Unfortunately, he was stereotypical, at least for a linesman. I understand quarterbacks are said to have some modicum of intelligence, but this young man did not. Or if he did, it was well hidden, because he conversed entirely in grunts, and you couldn't even tell whether he was assenting or dissenting with his grunts. He did, however, drink copiously, and so did I, so we managed to get through the evening, but it was not a match made in heaven. And it steered me clear of the blind dating thing nearly forever. I thought it was a very tiresome pastime. And then fortunately, Chuck came along back from Cornell, and that made a much easier situation for the rest of the year to sort of fit in. If you had a man at hand, they didn't bother you about blind dates, and you always had someone to go to these tiresome sorority events with. And Chuck pledged some fraternity or another down on Mendota Court, said to be a good fraternity. I don't think it was Sigma Chi, nothing that I recognize anymore, but they had events too, which consisted of numerous barrels of beer and lots of rowdy drunkenness, and we went to those, and I was usually blacked out for most of it, which was probably a mercy too. So that was the, but oddly enough, while this went on, I continued in this kind of schizophrenic existence on a different basis, which was that by day and into most weekday evenings, I was a very serious student, as was Joe. Joe was in integrated liberal studies, so she had a lot of really excellent professors, and I was in an honors program. So I had honors English and honors history, and forced to take science credits, I took geology and fell so in love with geology, which was very ably taught by Doc Loudon, that I almost became a geologist. I loved it, absolutely loved it, and I was amazed because I'd never been passionate about any science before. And French, a continuation of French because of my crush on the French teacher in high school. I'd taken quite a bit, so I had to go on in French, which I was never terribly good at. And but anyway, the sum and essence of it was that the week consisted of very intense intellectual excitement. And I absolutely loved it. And I loved the university. I loved the choices. My advisor and I hardly knew each other. I just did what I wanted to do and did well with it. And it was just a thrilling thing. And it's hard to realize that this very hard drinking and blacking out and all this stuff was going on one hand. And then I guess it's the resilience of youth. I don't know how I staggered around to classes after consuming that much alcohol so many nights of the week, but I did. And that was just the way it was. And so the freshman year, there was a highlight of the freshman year was a geology trip during spring break. We got to go down the Mississippi River with Doc Loudon and a bunch of World War II vets and a few other miscellaneous like-aged people. I think there was one other woman. And we dug fossils all the way, and we got to sleep in Tom Sawyer's cave in Hannibal. It was really cold, and we didn't have very warm sleeping bags. They were World War II surplus, and I think they had cotton batten in them or something. They weren't very warm. So I slept between two very warm, cozy, and non-predatory World War II vets. I think they were both married and very chaste, but they kept me warm, and I kept them warm, so that was good, and very asexual. And I learned to drink coffee, which was a treat. We camping all the way, so coffee was a real treat in the morning. And it was just very exciting. I found the best fossil on the whole trip. And Doc Loudon, my hero, said, "Wouldn't some damn woman find the best fossil?" That's the state of thing. And I didn't take umbrage because that was a natural sort of, I'd have batted him in the head with my geology hammer years later, but it didn't occur to me at the time. I thought he was a really neat man. He was a wonderful teacher. So that was quite the highlight of my freshman year. I came home so dirty and had to go to Whitefish Bay for the weekend and clean up and get spring wardrobe and stuff. And when I walked into the front door, Mother backed me out onto the porch and then into the front yard and got out the garden hose and turned it on me and said, "You're not coming in the house like that." And out of everything I had on, I was able only to save my much-cherished boots, my geology boots, because I think they were Red Wings, because they survived her soaking, but nothing else did. It was awful. And very classic mother-daughter interaction. It was charming. Cold water, very cold water. So that was the geology trip and the social life in some in essence. The dorm was an interesting experience. We had a lot of friends from Whitefish Bay and a lot of other friends, and one of the friends that I made came from the suburbs of Detroit, a suburb I think probably comparable to Whitefish Bay called Birmingham. Yeah, Birmingham. And her dad was the business editor, or not editor, he was the business officer. He ran the financial part of the now defunct Detroit Times, which was a Hearst paper, not my choice of newspapers. But thanks to my friend Janet, I got a summer job in Detroit. Her dad arranged it, and I lived with them part of the summer and then lived downtown in a sort of down-at-the-heels YWCA sort of place, which was very, very good. My job on the newspaper was, of course, in the newspaper library, which we used to call the morgue. And that was great because it involved reading newspapers from all over the country and clipping articles that were marked by our head librarian. and you had a sharp metal thing, and you tore out articles, and you scanned them and filed them. And so it was very interesting. I really liked it. And meanwhile, we had Windows. It was central to the office, because with no computers, we had the archives. We had all the information. When somebody died and had to be written up, or something happened and you had to check whether that person had been worthy of note, we were the source, and so they wanted us right there. So we had big windows right on the newsroom, which was just, ooh, I was so excited. I forgot to say, I started out in journalism and wrote articles for the Daily Cardinal, and that added very much to the excitement of life. I had a great time on the Daily Cardinal. I loved it. And I could write with fair facility, so I got nifty assignments. And anyway, that was fun. And the most memorable, well, two things were most memorable out of that experience. One was a woman who was the society editor, and her name was Vera Brown, and she was a character, a local character. Everybody in town knew her, kind of like Louise Marston was here, if you ever knew Louise. She was a spinster lady, always, no matter where she was, indoors or out, presumably in the shower and bed, I don't know, wore a big picture hat, a really big one, garden hat type thing in the summer, and a big felt thing in the winter. And she was pretty uninhibited, and they didn't have air conditioning in those days. They had ceiling fans that got very hot in this downtown Detroit in the summer. So she just stripped off her dress and would sit at her typewriter in her slip and her picture hat. And that's one of my favorite memories. And I loved her unconventionality and her comfort with it, because, I mean, everybody just treated her like she was in normal clothes, but she wasn't. She was in her slip, and her girdle showed, her corset, in fact, showed, and it was funny. But they were so used to it, nobody thought anything of it. And the other thing was that one day somebody stuck their head in and said, there's a man with a gun going after the editor's duck. So we all crawled under our desks until they got the police there. A man had come in waving his gun, and we didn't see it the incident very clearly, but we experienced the terror of it. And so that was interesting. The second part of the summer, when I lived down at this funny YWCA sort of place, I lived with a young woman who was a coal miner's daughter from Kentucky. Her mother taught piano, and this young woman, whose name was Lucy, was determined to become a concert pianist. And I get sad remembering her. She was a very intense, very smart, very talented, I think, brunette young woman, about my age, which then was, 19? And absolutely determined that somehow she was going to make enough money working at the gas and light company at this pathetic hourly wage that she was going to go to Juilliard. She was going to get a fellowship. And we had a horrible upright piano in the living room of this crummy YWCA-type place. And she would play for hours every night. And it wasn't even in tune. I mean, it was just... But she did wonderful things for me, because she was... Detroit at the time was a much nicer place than it is now. You could travel safely at night, two young women. And we went to free concerts all over the city. They had them out in the parks many, many nights of the week. And she wanted to go to them, and she knew how to handle the transportation system. So I got to do that with her, and it was a kind of exposure to that kind of culture that I'd never had, because, you know, my parents were big band music people. They weren't into this. They thought people who went to concerts were putting on pretensions. I had a cousin who did, and they thought he was just putting on airs. So anyway, that was a great experience, and I loved that. And I was really fond of her, and I'm sorry that we didn't stay in touch, although I think somehow I feel that she was destined to come to some sort of operatic, tragic end, that she would get consumption, TB or something, and she never seemed very well, and she just burned with this fire of her musical passion. And to be stultified all day by working in that kind of environment, doing small statistical work for a gas and lights company. Of course, T.S. Eliot did something like that, wrote marvelous poetry, so who knows. But anyway, that was another whole realm of experience. And sophomore year, the sorority sort of got put in its place. You didn't get to live in the house. You didn't have to live in the house till your junior year. So we started the year again in Ann Emery Hall. And we did the stuff that we had to do, just sort of pro forma. I got stuck with a job of emceeing in Formal Rush. They put on some kind of nautical skit, and I had to wear a sailor suit and be funny. And it was very painful because I didn't like the setting or the audience, and I could never remember jokes. I had to make them up as I went along because I just could not. So I pretty much had to ad-lib. I remember the whole thing feeling very difficult and very embarrassing, and I wanted not to be doing it, but there was no choice. You sort of did what they put you, behaved where they put you, and that was it. I suppose that was one of the social graces Mother wanted me to acquire. I don't know. Anyway, we got more involved in academe. Both Joe and I were getting closer to what we really wanted to do. I had an awfully interesting interview with Henry Ladd Smith, who was the premier person in journalism at the time, very well thought of all over the country. He'd been a newspaper man himself and was highly thought of as a teacher. Was an excellent teacher. He terrified us in reporting class. But he called me in and said, Jane, I don't think you should be majoring in journalism. He said, you can write. You can do this stuff. What you need to do is take history, take political science, so that you have a background for what you're writing about. If you're serious about being a reporter, you need to have more background. And he was thinking I might, you know, go for, I suppose, Associated Press or something like that. And he was right. He was absolutely right, because the other stuff was just skills stuff, and thanks to Whitefish Bay High School, I could write. So, and news writing came quite easily. I did have some wonderful experiences with it, though, when I took his course. One of them that comes to mind even now is that it was the height of McCarthyism, which you will remember, I'm sure, yourself, and some of the blacklist that so many was ruining so many people's lives in Hollywood and also in academe was much feared by some of the professors on campus. And Howard K. Beale, who is a renowned professor of American history, gave a speech for some event on campus that was attended by a lot of grown-ups, not just college kids, in which he said out loud that Thomas Jefferson would have been appalled by Joseph McCarthy. And that became headlines on the State Journal the next day. And my city editor called me in and said, Jane, I've got a real job for you. Howard K. Beale is really under fire, and he's terrified, and I need you to interview him and see if you can't change the complexion of this thing to something more appropriate, because he's, you know, he can be in deep trouble with this. And so I went and interviewed Howard K. Beale, and I bet the poor man was not reassured by the sight of this little sorority girl. I had to wear my stupid pin and my cashmere sweater and my tartan skirt and bobby socks. Imagine having that come to interview you when you're a distinguished professor of American history. But he just poured out. He was actually shaking. He was so terrified. And I remember his face when I think about what McCarthy did to people, with his accusations of communism and in what real danger he felt himself of losing everything that he'd striven for all of his life. And so I interviewed him and extracted the background for what was said out of context, in which the State Journal had done a very bad job of portraying, and got it written up in time for the deadline. And my city editor was immensely pleased with it. And the Daily Cardinal in those days had enough local prestige so that the other daily papers, the real city papers, actually paid attention to it, which is remarkable now when you think of the low standing of the student paper. But the Daily Cardinal really had a lot of, it had some great people who went on to great careers in journalism too. Anyway, I wrote it up, and I had just a lovely note. I think I had a phone call too from Howard K. Beale thanking me profusely and saying, you got it right. That's what I was saying. And it putting the context of Jefferson's philosophy and what McCarthy represented, which was the antithesis, of course, of Jefferson's philosophy. And so that was just a terrific experience in journalism, and I think in power, because my city editor treated me, he was just free of gender bias, and he just wanted somebody who could listen and have enough intelligence to sort it out and put it in words that would get it across, and he didn't care if I was blue, pink, purple, male, female, or transgender. He just didn't care. And that felt so good. It felt so freeing to have accomplishments like that and be recognized that way. Like anybody, I needed, you know, ego building, but to have the the gender thing, just a non-factor, I remember, had just great impact on me. So that was a very good experience and well worth being in journalism for. If nothing else had happened in journalism, I did get to write a lot of articles. I had a long, we called them string books. We had to clip everything that we had that appeared in print, whether in the Daily Cardinal or anything else, and paste them in like a scrapbook and then turn them in at the end of 6 weeks. And part of your grade was judgment on that. Reporting was sort of terrifying. No, if you misspelled a proper name or got an address wrong, a proper noun, street name, person's name, especially a person's name, you got an automatic F on your story regardless. There was no tolerance. None. So that was pretty interesting. And you had to meet your deadline, and you had like 2 or 3 hours. It must have been 3 hours. You had a lab, and you had a little table like this. You were not allowed to write anything out longhand except your notes. You had to hold those in your lap, and you had an old Royal typewriter, and you had to get back after your interview or whatever investigation you were doing and get that typed up and in by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, 4 o'clock, I don't remember, and with nothing misspelled or, and it was scary. It was really scary when in the class, but fortunately working for the Daily Cardinal was a little more relaxed than that. Oh, I got to interview Ogden Nash one time too. That was a blast. He was in a shabby old cardigan with patches at the elbows and carpet slippers. They couldn't even be called bedroom slippers. They were carpet slippers. And he was staying in the Memorial Union, and he was very grandfatherly and very sort of chivalrous and very, very quiet. I absolutely stood on my head and waved my legs trying to get some little snippets of things. I ended up writing a story based almost entirely on things of his that I knew by heart because I couldn't get him to say anything witty. He was done being witty, I guess, or he doesn't do it orally or something. I don't know. He was a very nice presence. He was very pleasant, but it was a terrible interview. It was just murder. So I don't know. I objurgate the centipede, and I don't know what all else of Ogden Nash's to try to get through that story. And it came out all right, but it wasn't an interview with Ogden Nash. It was a review of Ogden's verse. It was hilarious. Anyway, those were a couple of highlights of the Daily Cardinal thing. And again, I was proud to be chosen to do that, and probably over some boy children who were keen to do that kind of thing too, because I was good enough at it. So it was disregarded that I looked like a sorority girl, sort of, and was female. And journalism on the whole was not like that, but I think this was the beginning of the new era, which it came to be. And later on, I was privileged to meet a woman, quite a bit later on, a woman who was the first woman employed by a press association. It was not Associated Press, but United Press. And she was the first woman to hold down a job with it. And so there was discrimination, but it was starting to break down then. Anyway, I wasn't aware during this particular era of any very strong attractions to women, or for that matter, to men. I had this easygoing relationship with Chuck, which was almost asexual and comfortable, and it was sort of a non-issue because my passion was spent academically and my free time taken up socially and with alcohol, and it sort of all came out in the wash. It wasn't an issue. But my sophomore year, we're back in the same dorm, and one of the assistant house mothers was a graduate student in theater who had taught at the University of North Dakota the previous year. And one of her former students, previous couple years, one of her former students was now enrolled at the university studying theater. And they were good friends by now, now that they weren't student and teacher. And he would come to see her at the dorm. And one day she introduced me to him, and his name was Lloyd Besant. And he was gorgeous. He had curly black hair and big bedroom eyes, a lot of French, a lot of Mediterranean French in him, and very full lips. He was very sensuous looking, and he was tall and lean, and he had a voice to die for. He had run this school radio station when he was an undergraduate at the University of North Dakota, and he had just a marvelous, mellifluous voice. And not too long after Blanche introduced me to him, he asked me over for a Sunday night dinner. The dorms didn't feed us on Sunday night, so he invited me to his apartment. He was a graduate student. He had an apartment. He was in an old house over on, it was Sterling Court, and it was very typical graduate student digs at that time. He had the required, what do you call that, stripy Indian material that all the hippies made clothes out of for a tablecloth and thrown over the shabby furniture that came with the place. And I made the extremely unfortunate mistake of offering to do the dishes, whereupon he swept open the curtain in front of two orange crates and showed me that he had the whole week's dishes for me. And there was no sink in the room. You had to do dishes in the bathtub, in the bathroom. So I spent a long time on my knees doing dishes in the bathtub. And I should have known then. I should have known then, Linda, that this was not a good choice for me, but I didn't catch on. I didn't catch on. I fell in love with him. And I fell in love with the life he represented. One of the things that the University of Wisconsin can bring with it to undergraduates is a lot of excitement down in the Rathskeller, because that was the, like, the throbbing heart of the university. It was to me, anyway. And it was a very exciting place, because you would have a table of journalists, kids on the Daily Cardinal. You would have a table of theater people. You would have the sociologists. You would have the historians, blah, blah. And when I joined the Daily Cardinal, I got my place at the table. So I was part of the Rathskeller, and I just loved it. But I always was intrigued by the theater table, because they wore such outre clothing. Turtlenecks weren't in then, and they were already wearing turtlenecks. And a lot of the men had longish hair, and the women had incredibly long hair. And they all would, like, stand up and proclaim, and they were all showing off for one another. I mean, their egos would fill the whole Rathskeller, I'm sure. But I was just caught up by their flamboyance and by the fact that it wasn't anything you'd see in the Whitefish Bay High School cafeteria, and that it seemed exotic, and it sort of fitted with my reading of the time, which was all about things like Bloomsbury and these unconventional people. And I started to shape a sense of, that's the kind of society I could thrive in. That's it. And so, of course, when I started dating Lloyd, I had an alternative table with the theater people. And they loved me being there because I was audience. These people are terrible audience for one another because they all want to carry on simultaneously. And whoever was on stage then in whatever was running at the Union Theater would be the hero of the day. And they would proclaim the most and be the biggest pain in the neck. But I didn't see them that way. I saw them as, you know, like temporary heroes or something. I was just really, really caught up in it. And Lloyd was very much a part of this. And he wore reasonably theatrical clothing and was very dramatic. He had French gesticulation and then this beautiful voice. And so we started dating regularly. And but interestingly enough, that was also pretty asexual, affectionate, but asexual. And I was kind of relieved by that. I wasn't really drawn to the whole concept of having sex with men. And it wasn't an era where it was still, where it was an easy thing to do. We hadn't gotten into the 60s. We're talking, I was 19, turning 20, so we're talking 1951-52, when I met Lloyd. And that was still a pretty straight-laced era. The World War II vets came home wanting a little house and a little picket fence and 2.7 children, and they had a real clear vision, and the rest of us were supposed to subscribe to this very straight, rather narrow, very, very conventional, very traditional sex role kind of thing. And so most of that I discarded, but I liked the asexual part. I didn't want complications of that sort. I had too much going on, and it just didn't appeal to me. And it didn't bother me that it didn't appeal to me. It seemed not to appeal to Joe either, who was dating someone else by then, and it didn't bother her either. We were just both kind of, we're both kind of androgynous kids anyway, and very interested in people, but just sex was not a consuming thing with either of us. We didn't get into college pornography or all the stuff that passes around in dorms or any of that stuff. We were much more interested in stuff like the Greek philosophers. God help us, we really were. So it's, you know, it was strange, but it worked. So anyway, I dated Lloyd, and somewhere in the middle of the year, about just before Christmas, I think. He had exams in January in those days. Joe and I got very restless, and we were starting to feel like parasites. We were both living on our parents. We're living in this cushy dorm, which is really an extension of Whitefish Bay, because all the other kids were from some other suburb, maybe a Chicago suburb. And we were taking out of this environment that we both loved, but we didn't feel.
Here we go.
I picture us still sitting, I think, cross-legged on the dorm floor, which probably isn't true because I don't think we had room on our floor in our double single room to sit cross-legged. We were probably perched on the furniture as usual, but saying we've got to do something that gives back. We've got to change our lives. Something's wrong with this where we just do all this wonderful stuff and somebody else pays for it, and we're with all these people that are cushioned against real life and blah, blah. And we went through a long thing about what we could possibly do, and we got quite dramatic. We thought it would be good if we were like some sort of poor nun scrubbing floors in hospitals or something, you know. Very sophomoric behavior, very sophomoric in retrospect, but we were very earnest about it. And somehow all of this got parlayed, don't ask me how, into the realization that what we really wanted to do was go to Europe. Now, why this was non-parasitic, I don't understand, but we decided we would go to Europe. We had to experience other cultures, and then we'd know how life should really be, because you couldn't tell if you grew up in a suburb and lived in Ann Emery Hall and hung out with all the same kinds of people. We had to have different cultures. So we evolved a grand plan. Fortunately, in those days, the dollar was enormously strong, just powerful, and it wouldn't cost a whole lot of money, except we didn't have any. So we cajoled our parents into letting us move into a co-op, which cost about half as much as Ann Emery Hall, and giving us the difference. And we cut our credit loads to 12 credits and looked for part-time jobs. And after brief abortive attempts at getting jobs in retail, for which neither of us was suited, we both got jobs, surprise, surprise, at the university library, which was then in the old Historical Society, and we got jobs in the catalog department. And the reason we got jobs was that Irene Doyle, who was head of the catalog department, looked up our grade point records, and she wanted smart kids, so she got us. And they were perfect jobs because you had totally flexible schedules. You just had drawers you worked on, and it was in an atmosphere that we both adored. The old reading room in that library where the card catalogs was so mellow. It had these wonderful reading lights like the New York Public Library and wooden tables, and I've never enjoyed the pink portals of the new library half as much as I enjoyed that wonderful wooden stone place at the old Historical Society, and it was just a wonderful place for two young intellectuals to work. We had a great time. We loved it. And so we got those jobs, and then we became very focused that way. And my social life with Lloyd was fine. He was fine with that because that was a goal of his, too, to go to Europe. He, however, would be working on his master's degree. He would have to do a performance. He was putting on a play that summer, so there was no question of his going to Europe. Anyway, it would have been an awkward trio. He and Joe weren't passionate about each other. And so we didn't, but we went on dating, and he was very interested in talking about our trip, and so that was all just fine. And our parents, I'm really amazed in retrospect that they fed into this, because what we were going to do was something that's done much more commonly now. We were going to have bicycles and bicycle around Europe, two women alone, no group, no chaperones, no nothing. And we were going traveling on what they called a student ship in those days. It was kind of like steerage. We got our whole trip from Montreal for $309 round trip on this. It was a Greek ocean-going vessel, I hesitate to call it a ship, which flew the flag of some African country because it didn't meet standards for more dignified countries coverage, and probably Albania or something. And we were in the cheapest accommodations, which was a dorm sort of setting in the stern where the engine rumbled, and I think there were 12 of us crammed into this thing in triple bunks. But we were just ecstatic. We had to buy our bicycles here because you couldn't buy bicycles in Europe. They were for export only as a result of the World War II situation over there. And so we went to Europe for the summer. And we just had an absolutely fabulous summer. After the first 3 days, we were unfortunately rather indolent for the 9 days of our ocean trip and sat around and ate too much instead of jumping rope like some perverse people did on deck, whom we envied when we got to shore and had to get on our bicycles. Because we discovered then that the way England works is it's kind of like the globe. It all goes uphill to Scotland. The whole thing is uphill. And we started out badly. We got into customs in Southampton close to 9 at night when they closed. And the customs men had to put our bikes together just to get us out of there so they could go home. But they were very gracious about it. And then we promptly started out on the wrong side of the road, as one tends to do when one comes from America. So, and we spent our first night. Our plan was to sleep in youth hostels when it was convenient, but to sleep rough when it wasn't convenient. And we didn't get far enough, due to it all being uphill and us being in such terrible shape, to get to a youth hostel. So we found a thing that was like a little roadside park or wayside maybe, and stretched out our sleeping bags, and there we were with our bicycles and us. And about 10 o'clock at night, a car pulled in, and a young couple said, "Are you quite all right?" And we assured them that that was our intent, and we were fine, and we were comfortable, and we were going to spend the night. And bless their hearts, they came back and checked on us later. Mm-hmm. They were so worried about us. They didn't have room in their car to put us in their bikes and everything and take us home, or I'm sure they would have. And then we mostly stayed in youth hostels, but sometimes, a youth hostel was full when we went to Stratford-on-Avon. We saw a wonderful, wonderful performance of The Tempest for just a few cents. We did it on standing room, and it was literally like 10 cents to see this fantastic play with great English Shakespearean actors. But then we got on our bicycles and go in the youth hostels full. So we just kind of rode out in the countryside. There was a hedge, and we crawled through the hedge, pulled our bikes in, spread out our sleeping bags, pitch dark. Crows awakened us about 4 in the morning, and we looked up, and somebody's bay window was right as close as this wall, about 6 feet from us, and there we were in all of our overnight splendor. So we got out of there very fast before the household woke up. And we had the one other kind of adventure we had with the hedges was that it was a great place to hide behind a pea, just so you weren't viewed from the road. And we were both peeing behind a hedge one day when a double-decker bus went by. And that was mutual astonishment, us and the people in the top mm-hmm. deck. That was really fun. So, and we had great times all over. The youth hostels were an experience of many other 19, 20-year-olds. We were 20 by then. And we spent a month in England. We visited a woman who was considered an aunt in my family. And we went up to Scotland. We stayed in Edinburgh, nearly froze to death on the 4th of July in a bitterly cold, damp hotel with the winds, but we loved Edinburgh anyway. And then we stayed with Aunt Anne in Yorkshire and had a marvelous time in London and did Oxford. And one more memorable moment was we were leaving England that day by ferry. Of course, you didn't have a chunnel then. And you go downhill for about 2 miles to the White Cliffs of Dover. And on the way down the hill to the White Cliffs of Dover, my brake blocks flew off. So I had no braking capacity on my bike. And my choice was to go over the White Cliffs into the channel or to throw myself into a field with a stone wall and hedge row and stuff. I think it was a stone wall and a sort of ditch. So fortunately, I really had trouble deciding. It was hard to throw yourself when you're on a bike, and it was running. I was going very fast, but I did and survived the experience. And then we had to walk our bikes into Dover and get new brake blocks. And fortunately, although they didn't sell bikes, they had lots of parts because everybody was keeping pre-war bikes running. These were 3-speeds, by the way. They look very archaic now, but Americans were still riding 1-speed bikes with coaster brakes, so they were really state-of-the-art. They were marvelous bikes to us. And they didn't have nifty accoutrements in those days. They had panniers that you made yourself. We made panniers out of army surplus day bags, big, heavy canvas things, and they weren't stiff enough, so they kept catching in the spokes, so we had to put cardboard down. And they also, unfortunately, didn't have Tampix in Europe yet in those days, so each of us had one bag entirely full of Tampix because we figured we'd menstruate 3 times in the summer. And wouldn't you know, bicycling so rigorously made me not have one period, so I came home with surplus Tampix, which was very irritating because we were short of space. But we crammed everything into the remaining pannier and a bag in the front. And then we went to Europe. We biked across Belgium. We biked across Holland, which was marvelous. They have whole highways set up for bikes with traffic lights and everything, and escalators going under the canals. You pick up your bike and carry it down under the canal, which was a bit interesting. And we did that, and then went into Germany. And Joe particularly wanted to go to Heidelberg because her dad had been stationed there and had fond memories of it. He'd been stationed there during the post-war period, and he was a colonel, so he lived rather well. And we went to Heidelberg. We biked along the Neckar River, which was very beautiful. And then we started up the Alps. Oh, three-speed bikes going up the Alps. Americans. Uh-uh. German kids and who knows what other kids kept going past us on the road, and they would have legs like tree trunks. You know, they had biked all their lives everywhere, and they had thighs that would take them up to the top of any mountain. They were the Lance Armstrongs of their day, I guess. Just amazing, and we just couldn't do it. We absolutely could not. It was humbling, very humbling experience. Also, they had 10 and 12 speed bikes, which we'd never even heard of. So we came to grips with reality, and we stopped and bought rucksacks. Backpacks hadn't come in here yet either, so we had our first backpack experience, and it was great. I loved my rucksack. It had leather things with little decorations, and all we needed was lederhosen, and we'd have been perfect. And we shipped our bikes to Paris on the train. Joe somehow got through it with her pidgin German. She had a little German. And she managed to get us through Germany. I had pidgin French. I got us through France. And then we stuck our thumbs out and hitchhiked. And we hitchhiked up through Switzerland and then southern France, middle of France. And we had good luck. We had two wild Swiss men pick us up. Or maybe they were Italian. I don't know. They were very cute, and they had a really cute car. And they got in and just took off like bullets, and we just sort of cowered in the back seat. It was a convertible, and let the wind go over us and prayed. It was just, neither of us was a praying sort of person, but we prayed, because you're up and down Alps, you're just, and these guys were so used to it, they paid no. And then they stopped and did sign language to tell us this was it, and we got out, and then we had more sedate travel after that, but anyway. And we stayed in youth hostels, and that was fun, and we got to have 2 weeks in Paris. We had just enough money for 2 weeks in Paris, which was great, absolutely great. Oh, we got adopted by an elderly man in Switzerland who took us to a small village that he felt we should experience, so we'd know places other than Zurich, and we went up a mountain that was in the lap of the Jungfrau to a little village called Muren, which he was fond of, and he found us cheap quarters, and then he took us out on walks and showed us the wildflowers, and I'm afraid, though, that he died not long after that because he was a heavy, heavy smoker and he had the most god-awful cough you ever heard. So I don't think Uncle Alfred was long for this world, but he was very dear to us. And then we went to Paris and stayed in the cheapest hotel we could find, and that was amazing. It was $2 a night, including breakfast of sorts, which would be café au lait and day-old baguette. Day-old baguette are hard to chew, but we did that. And the bed was so narrow in our supposedly double room that we took turns sleeping on it. Mm-hmm. One of us would have sleep on both sleeping bags on the floor and the other in the bed. But it didn't matter because we loved Paris. And my old high school boyfriend, the boring one, was stationed in England with the army, and we had a little time with him in England, and he came over to France with a buddy so they could take us out so we could go to some nightclubs and things. He was still boring, but it was a really sweet thing to do. And it was kind of fun to see somebody from home. They were nice, wholesome kids, and they were in uniform, and so it was fun. And we had a great time. But something happened that last week. If you've ever gone on a really long trip, it may have happened to you. I began thinking about home, and I began thinking about Lloyd Besant with his beautiful eyes and his mellifluous voice, and I got really kind of anxious to get home to Lloyd. I didn't think much about my parents or the dorm or anything. I wanted to get home to Lloyd. And so when we got home, Lloyd, meanwhile, had acquired a teaching job in Wausau, Wisconsin. And he came for that first weekend, an arduous trip because he didn't have a car. He managed to get himself to Milwaukee. And we had just loads to talk about. And I remember that on Sunday morning, I was in bed in my pajamas, quite decently clad, and Lloyd was sitting on the edge of my bed. I don't remember if he was in his pajamas or his clothing, but Mother looked in and saw him sitting on my bed and said, that's it, I will not have that kind of behavior going on in my house. I mean, we weren't even touching. And she banished him. So we made secret arrangements to meet at Charlie Toy's Chinese restaurant later in the day, when I was ostensibly on my way back to Madison, I guess, and we did. And at Charlie Toy's restaurant, we decided that we were going to get married. I'd had, I think, 2 weeks of school, and I was supposed to live with a blind woman that your our sorority read to the blind as a charitable thing. And I'd met a woman who liked me, and I liked her, and she needed a roommate, and it was a way to earn a living. So I thought I could help her with stuff and make the university much less costly and so on. And so we plotted our elopement, and I went back to school, and it must have been, well, it wasn't as immediate as I'm thinking now in my memory, because I do remember, surprisingly enough, I do remember my first wedding anniversary, and it was October 25th. Joel had always pledged to be my maid of honor, and she went with me, and Lloyd had some male whose name I don't even remember, and we went to Chicago, because in Chicago, they were quite, in Cook County, they were quite happy to falsify the date of the blood test. You were supposed to have 3 days twixt blood test and marriage, and they were very cheerful. Illinois was corrupt in all matters then, as now. And so it was not recently invented, Illinois corruption. So we managed to get married in Chicago, and we came back to the Edgewater Hotel for a one-night honeymoon, and it was a mercy it was one night, because it cost way too much for us, and our room was on the elevator, and it was unbelievably noisy. And neither of us had any talent for sex at all, and the whole thing was a complete fiasco, and it was a relief to get up to Wausau and take up what seemed to be the next stage of life. And as I look at the clock, it looks like that's going to be an end on it, because that's a whole story unto itself. Surprise, surprise. Life is, I'm going to be demoted very rapidly from aspiring young intellectual and world traveler to dreary, jobless housewife, wife of a school teacher in Wausau, Wisconsin. It was one of the perhaps outer circles of hell, and I need to leave us there for now.